Ladies and gentlemen, before we begin this week's The Experience, I think you know what it's time for. No? I bet you don't. Get ready to blow your eardrums out. Didgeridoo! That was the musical stylings of Dr. Jesse Herbert, who is... Well, he's going to make sense of all of that for us. He was on the show before as Jesse. Now he's going by his full real name, and we're going to find out why that is as well. So welcome to the program, Jesse. Thank you for returning.
Yeah, thank you, Jeremy. Thank you very much. I'm really delighted to be talking to you again after, I guess it's been, I don't know, maybe a few years since you had me once on the show. And I just was prompted to get back in touch with you from last week's show when you and Whitley were talking about returning from the Esalen conference.
Which, by the way, I should add, I just received an email from one of the students who was studying mediums for 10 years, I think a lot of it in China, and studying, you know, ghosts and all this stuff. And she found our questions interesting and had a lot to add in the email. So I've asked her to come on the show because I think she could add a lot to this dialogue of where these messages come from. And she's actually looked into a little bit what are the limitations of ghost contact versus spirit contact versus channeling contact, you know. What are the limits of these communication types? So just FYI, in the future, let's hope and pray she comes on the show. I think she will. But anyway, go ahead.
Sure. Nice. Yeah, you know, actually, years ago, I remember Whitley talking about being a little hesitant with channeled information, and I can certainly understand. Personally, being a trained scientist, I'd like to have things that I can kind of verify and vet. You know, in some ways, I really consider myself a lifelong student of Whitley's, in that his kind of approach always really appealed to me, being honest about sort of his experience of life, and even including the things that aren't really culturally investigated, but also his sort of unwillingness to just jump on any alternative belief bandwagon. But you know, even more than his deep desire to understand what the heck's going on with some of these experiences, I've always been really, inspired or resonate with his sort of hunger to expand those experiences and not just kind of say, wow, what's going on, but actually to maybe increase what's going on, if you would, you know, in terms of the good or the ecstatic aspects, probably not the terrifying ones.
Well, yeah, of course, everyone would love to expand their ecstatic experiences. Like, who wouldn't want that? The problem is that the terrifying goes with it, for whatever reason, at least in terms of these phenomena that we call, quote-unquote, alien abduction.
We'll be back after this.
One UnknownCountry.com subscriber says, "The subscriber offering has blossomed into an indispensable tool for my spiritual growth. Unknown Country has revitalized my sense of awe and wonder. I am very happy to participate in this exciting adventure." Listen to what another one has to say.
"I've been a subscriber to Unknown Country from almost the beginning. I get information there I can get nowhere else on the web."
And think of what you get. Commercial-free access to every Dreamland since 2004. Hundreds of special interviews, the astonishing meditations of Whitley Strieber, a small collection of UFO videos, but one that is rock solid authentic, unlike so much you find elsewhere. Plus, the satisfaction of knowing that you support the best edge science website in the world.
Unknown Country, genuinely new, genuinely credible like nothing else in the world. Subscribe today. We need you. And you'd be surprised. Once you start, you'll realize you need to be a part of this community too. Click on that subscribe tab today.
Welcome back.
So would you want to expand the ecstatic if it came with the terror as well?
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking a lot about what I wanted to say besides just why I wanted to say it. And, you know, in the past when we spoke, I was talking about lucid dreaming, for example, and a lot of people are familiar with the idea of becoming conscious in a dream and not just necessarily being at the whim of whatever the dream's throwing your way. But I think it's also really important to remember that, like, actually, Whitley was just interviewing the guy recently talking about the finding the clues and following intuition, the guy who's bringing sort of like Zen to entrepreneurship. I forget his name.
Okay.
But he, you know, he mentioned a dream mentor of that he found helpful, Robert Moss. And one of the things that I really enjoyed reading his books, because I'm kind of familiar with him also and really highly recommend his books, is the idea that, you know, we don't want to become conscious and conscious dreamers sometimes if we have the opportunity just to say, oh, wow, look what I can do. Or, okay, now I'm going to go and just sort of throw an energetic smackdown on everything in front of me. And in fact, there's the story of a woman who kept having a reoccurring nightmare of a wolf. And finally she faced it in sort of a conscious moment in this sort of, you know, repeating dream experience and asked it why it kept tormenting her. And it said, I'm lupus. Tell your doctors. And she did, lo and behold, have lupus. So she needed the encounter with that, what had been terrifying thing, because it was actually giving her information that she needed to act on. And maybe I suspect that that's part of what's happening here with the aspect of our encounter with the other or the unknown, you know, whatever we call it. Maybe something that we need to understand.
Yeah. Well, let me derail the conversation for one second and ask you this, because you just brought this to mind and you're a doctor, so you'll appreciate this and have a great answer for it. You know, as you're talking about lucid dreaming and we don't want to do this, we want to do that. The potent ways in which we lucid dream, I think come from mainly from other cultural sources, that these things are brought up in the culture. So if, my friends in Hawaii and Teokasin of the Lakota are correct that culture isn't just a social construct, but actually comes up from the land through people. Or as Willie Iakua put it, comes from the elements. Then there are ways that are stronger in different parts of the world. Different things work differently in different parts of the world, I guess is what I'm getting at. And when scientists or researchers or nowadays just, you know, New Age or spiritual seekers come in from the West, what they're looking to do is extract that universal property of it that they can then sell to the world or use themselves, bring it with them when they go to the next culture, and just sort of, you know, take from all these cultures and try to extract the universal component. But perhaps there isn't a universal component that can be extracted or divorced from the place, from the culture and from the place, that one needs to be of that culture or that place for the real, you know, truth and potency of that teaching to come through. Is that something that feels real to you? Or do you think that we can just keep sort of taking what we want here and there and, you know, put together a vision of the world that is just sort of general and universal and marketable?
Well, no, that makes a lot of sense, especially because my view of the world sort of has evolved over time to include the idea that even ourselves aren't really just sort of individuals walking around so much as maybe cells in a body, and that there are maybe just like we have specialized cells that sort of collectively do various tasks and whatnot. I think there are potentially kind of that phenomenon even going on in cultures. And so it makes a lot of sense that it isn't, you know, sort of the way we are used to looking at it from a Western perspective. And it's kind of funny to me that you talked about derailing conversation and bringing up that point, because actually that's been very much at the forefront of my thinking leading up to our conversation here today. And one of the things I was just pondering was how many times sustainable cultures, because I teach sustainability, I teach mathematics and sustainability. And one of the things that I find sort of continuing to occur to me is how many indigenous cultures sort of had, you know, a set of ways of being here that just seemed to work well, really well, across vast stretches of space and time. And, you know, a lot of times we might make the assumption from a Western view, oh, they just sort of figured out by trial and error which plants to eat and food to eat and what to do. But if you actually ask them, and a lot of anthropologists, from what I've read in the past, seem to be saying, well, when you ask them, they just say the plants told them, or, you know, the knowing was making itself obvious to them, you know, almost like from the outside or coming through. And, you know, in a way, many cultures maybe also had shamans or people who were more conscious or lucid, perhaps, of these processes. And many times individual members just sort of knew that this was the way. It didn't, you know, almost like a subconscious carrying out of an execution of right livelihood. Sort of, I suspect what might be going on in the modern world is a marriage of our Western sort of freaking out on logic approach, which in some ways has brought about some incredible options in terms of dealing with what nature might throw at us. But at the same time, you know, you're probably somebody, and I continue to really enjoy hearing your perspective over time in the different interviews, that appreciates some of these other kind of non-Western views in a way, you know, you're able to articulate well.
Well, yeah, because, you know, I got to thinking, I was reading some stories from Hawaii, and a lot of the, gee, how did they discover fire story, for instance, a lot of these stories are, you know, someone out in the woods, and then here's a voice, and the voice says, rub these two sticks together and you'll get fire. And the only thing around are these birds, so they assume the birds are talking to them. And then I think about, I've talked about on the show, my trip down Palolu Valley, where a voice internally, that was me but not me, said, take off your shoes. And I argued with it and said, I'm gonna stumble around. No, your feet will know where to go. Well, it's gonna hurt. Yeah, it'll hurt for a minute, but then you'll get over it. Just do it. And I don't feel as though this is me completely, but it sure sounds like my own internal voice giving me these instructions. And I thought maybe there's some sort of, you know, Hawaiian spirit who knows the land and is telling me to do this. But maybe the land itself needs to be traveled that way for whatever reason. The contact of the body and the earth in this particular place needs to be traversed that way. And so maybe it comes up as an instruction if you're open to hearing it. And so I just wonder about that. And then I wonder, as you were saying about the plants told me, well, is there something about that relationship and that connection that is important to the actual medicine that the plants are conveying? And in fact, if these scientists were open to listening to the plants in their own area, would they need to travel to the Amazon to find cures for things? Because wouldn't they be in A, better balance with nature, but then B, hearing where the cure is, in their own place? Is that a more potent cure than something extracted and put into a pill with side effects and whatever out of the Amazon? But I guess that would be game over for Big Pharma if they were to figure that out, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. In fact, it reminds me of something. There's a guy here from Vietnam. There's a book written about him called Fourth Uncle in the Mountain, a memoir of a barefoot doctor. And I guess a woman from Vermont helped him write the book. His English isn't the best. He sort of escaped, you know, communist Vietnam, but was, I guess, himself an orphan in Vietnam and was raised by this sort of master Chinese medicine guy. And if you read that book, it's kind of incredible. Him talking, one of the women who I know from where I used to teach was his neighbor for many years. He's lived here now and practiced medicine in southern Vermont for 20 years or so. And she said she kind of found some of the things in the book just impossible. How could they possibly be true? I read his book and he does talk about some incredible things that to us just seem like they are too far out. But one of the interesting things relating to what you just said about medicine is he stated that there's over 70% of the medicinal plants here, right in southern Vermont, that he needs and uses compared to the mountains of Vietnam where he was. And he's had a successful practice. I mean, you can barely get to see the guy. I was tutoring some Vietnamese girls, and that's why I got in to see him. And he read my pulse and told me exactly what was wrong with me and where I had a blood flow restriction in my spine, which came from a previous injury. It's like a different way of knowing he's using. It's not so much analytical.
We'll be back after this.
The Afterlife Revolution is getting great reviews. There's a tremendous, lovely response to it, and I'm so pleased and humbled, because it's an effort on the part of myself and Anne, and I love Anne so much. I want her to succeed in this incredible task that she has undertaken of returning and communicating across the bridge between the worlds, and she's really doing it. This is a real thing that's happening. Listen to some of these reviews. Anne and Whitley Strieber lay out their life's work in the most exquisitely beautiful manner. This moving book comes from the heart, the unified heart of two people who have dedicated their lives in this realm and the next to revealing the nature of consciousness as it makes its sojourn in this human form. That's just one. Here's another. I love this book. It's a wonderful read, especially if you lost somebody very close to you. Just incredible. Here's another one. The book shows you how to grow your soul, for lack of a better term. Through Anne's insight, Whitley shares invaluable information that could only be from the other side. So take it seriously. Go to Amazon and get Afterlife Revolution. Go on to Amazon and get the Afterlife Revolution in paperback or in Kindle format. And if you have questions or thoughts, write me at whitley@strieber.com. I'm right here. I'm ready to answer anything you ask to help you in any way I can, always.
Visit unknowncountry.com every day to get the latest news from the edge and open your mind to the high strangeness of the out there section of the website. You can follow us on Twitter simply by following Whitley Strieber, and all the latest material will be pushed to your Twitter feed. Plus, you can subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and get the latest delivered right to your inbox. UnknownCountry.com is the biggest and most popular website of its kind in the world because it has so much to offer. Open your mind. Dare the edge. Subscribers to UnknownCountry.com get so much more. A new special interview every week. Commercial-free dreamland. Above all, access to our vast archive that includes many of Whitley Strieber's most famous books in audio form. Communion, Transformation, Majestic, Superstorm, and there's even more. The Dreamland Archive goes back 10 years,
It's a treasure trove of unusual information, literally unparalleled in the world, and can offer you hours and hours of truly mind-opening listening pleasure. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab today. Join us. We need you, and you need us.
Welcome back.
Do you get the sense that his way of knowing takes a lifetime to be in tune with or to figure out or to just basically learn? Or do you think it's something where you could learn from him within, say, a couple of years like you would at a school?
You know, it's a great question. And I've thought my entire life about that question, because I've often suspected and sort of lamented the loss of sort of wild intuition. And as a child, I would look at animals and birds and be like, why can they just live and know what to do and know what to eat? And how come, you know, we seem to be racked by so much doubt and, unknowing? And how come these other cultures seem to just have fluidity? And I guess in some ways I've come to suspect that there is something about our sort of maybe overly logical way of dealing with reality that has blinded us. Now the question, can you still, from our perspective, sort of, let's say a Western raised one, can we study with someone like that and, you know, learn it in a reasonable amount of time and not just say, well, hopefully it works out better next incarnation. you know, in some ways that itself relates very much to what I think's going on with Paul Selig. And it's why when I heard you and Whitley sort of saying, wow, what's going on with him and the channeling, and boy, he seems like a nice guy and down to earth. But you know, the channeling seems a little wacky, you know, or arrogant or something. And I have to be honest and say that I've been sort of sitting on my experience and kind of biting my tongue and holding myself back from getting back in touch with you in the past few years while I've been kind of following his stuff and getting more and more into it, because I just thought, man, I get, you know, it's not really the right time for, it might be almost explosive if you combine people who are sort of very aware that reality itself has these incredible sort of unexplainable or unknown aspects to it, with somebody who's also sort of tuning in and saying, hey, you know, hey, so something from the other side is saying some stuff to try to do. And wow, it feels interesting when I do that. My experience with some of that has only come about, and I want to say that before I go into any of my actual personal experience, I sort of wanted to talk about the very logical and Western-based, maybe scientific reasons why I even considered going there and checking it out at all.
Now, where did you go? Do you mean just reading his books, or have you met him and I don't know, taken a class or something?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yep. I have. And I've done workshops.
So you've done the attunements, because we did an attunement. I don't know that we talked about this on the show or not, but, you know, Paul channeled for us while he was talking. And part of what we did was an attunement, which a lot of people felt. I didn't really feel anything. I felt it was more sort of a hypnosis thing than anything else. But, you know, which, and again, you know, just so people are clear, these are all, you know, quote unquote criticisms that Paul is cool with. Like, I could say any of this to Paul Selig and he would A, agree, or B, be fine with it. So these aren't, I just don't want people to think that I'm just ragging on Paul Selig or anything like that. It's not like that at all. In fact, I may ask him to be on the show at some point. The problem is I'd rather talk to him. I don't really have a use for these channels. But maybe you will convince me otherwise. So go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, no, what you're saying is exactly right. And, you know, he has said point blank that he's not interested in proving whether he's a con artist or not, or anything, he's just kind of doing his thing and reporting what he's hearing. But before I really say what, you know, I've experienced or not, or I have to say that, you know, because I'm aware of my sort of heavily westernized, logical approach to the world, I've often thought, okay, well, scientific data is pretty useful in ferreting out what is effective or not, or what's consistently working or not. So I'll try that approach. And going back to my childhood, and you and a lot of listeners, Whitley, I'm sure, have the same sort of sideshow carnival or parade, as you've talked about, you know, these bizarre things that just don't really fit that whole model, but nevertheless are real. And I mean, we've experienced, you know, what does real really mean? But we certainly have had these experiences that are hard to kind of put into the box that our culture sort of put itself in. And, you know, some of the things, like, I sort of have often throughout my life tried to combine sort of an intuitive approach with a logical one. It seemed to me like just my best strategy. For example, when I was younger, trying to figure out what the heck was wrong with my health and why was I starting to have, you know, like arthritic like symptoms and just worsening allergies and chronic problems with, you know, congestion or pain. And tiredness, just so many things. I just suspected that there was something wrong with, you know, my ability to just intuit what I needed to do for vibrancy. But I also was sort of trying to pay attention to clues from wherever they came from, you know, and science was for me just one place, but it certainly wasn't the exclusive place. So, you know, like the last time we spoke, I was talking about sugar and some of the dangers and stuff like that. And, you know, there's so many people who could give you dietary advice. I do remember when I was younger, Whitley saying that ETs or visitors, whatever, had sort of been hinting that sugar, you know, could be an issue.
Yeah.
Sugars, whatnot. And that, you know, that sort of helped me look a little deeper and closer when I started seeing evidence that, hey, maybe the body does struggle with sugars. And then, you know, I got deeper into understanding of autophagy and ketosis. You know, ketosis is the body burning fat for fuel instead of sugar. Autophagy is our body sort of cleaning up damaged cells and old tired ones when we're fasting. And, you know, so like that tip from somebody like Whitley Strieber helped me learn about the science that is now just emerging, and really only in the past several years, people are practicing it and seeing tremendous benefits from all kinds of things. One of the links I had pulled up and wanted to talk about was somebody wrote an article mentioning how there's a really deeply mystical / spiritual side to fasting and being in ketosis. I guess it makes sense if you think a lot of monks and whatever have done that. And I would definitely say that over the past several years, not only has my health, you know, gotten a lot less aggravating, but I've definitely had a continuing escalation in my, you know, more raw experiences, or just deeply connected sort of union type experiences with the world around me, with nature and other living things, plants, people, animals. So there's really something there is value in the science, because I probably wouldn't have pushed myself through the difficult period, the 2 to 4 weeks that it takes for your body to readapt to burning fat as a fuel and being ketogenic, so that I could comfortably and almost lazily, you know, get my health back. you know, I had to sort of have that evidence to push me through the sort of pain in the neck phase of it. And I guess what, you know, what I'm saying is some of that same type of investigative approach led me to take Paul's stuff more, to give it, you know, to give it a go, to see how it was. And I really must also bring up that Jeffrey Kripal, the fact that he wrote, and I had just read Supernatural and really enjoyed both, you know, he and Whitley's points and everything, you know, that book was great. And then when I saw him having written the foreword for the Book of Mastery, that when Paul came out with that, that was actually the first book I bought. I was like, wow, okay, so this guy who just wrote a book with Whitley is saying, you know, he had these experiences of Paul correctly channeling his wife and being spot on. And so, wow, that's kind of an interesting verification. And that gets to the idea of wisdom of crowds, which I have to touch on for a moment. Maybe you're aware of that. Have you ever heard of that, the wisdom of crowds?
I've never heard of that, but let me just inject this because I'm not sure since I haven't read the book. But I do know that Paul Selig has at least two things going on. One is the channeling, but the other is a type of mediumship where he inhabits the person or the animal, but the person who is coming to him and like sees them from the inside, right? And so that might have been what he was doing with Jeff's wife, right? As opposed to yes. Channeling and giving her information.
Yeah, I've had a session with him where he did that with like my mother and my cousin, my wife. Yeah, and he was right on the money. And I don't know if he would say he inhabits as much as just feels the part of himself that's overlapping with them or something. You know, I don't know. I probably shouldn't speak for him, but nevertheless, he's pretty good at it. Like you can go on YouTube and watch some, I don't know if it's ABC reporters or somebody just sort of being impressed with him getting it right. So he's definitely skilled with that.
Yeah, I think that part is not really controversial in terms of, you know, what abilities are going on here. I think the mediumship right. part of it, or right. not the medium, but whatever that is called, that psychic aspect is real, which is why I had asked him, yes. could this be a, you know, could you be mistaking your own stream of consciousness for other channeled entities since you are psychic? It would be very easy to mistake your own voice for someone else's voice doing those sort of vocal gymnastics and because you are psychic. So why wouldn't it be somebody else?
Absolutely an excellent question, and one that I totally wonder when it comes to stuff like that and have asked myself and thought exactly along those lines. Is this guy just sort of tapping into a subconscious Mozart that's sort of incredibly good, or like a split personality part of himself that's incredibly good at sort of synthesizing spiritual truisms and just coming out with them all the time in response to people's questions in ways that make beautiful sense, which is why, and honestly, a good scientist will always be asking themselves devil's advocate type questions and trying to entertain alternative hypotheses, because you really have to. You have to look at all these possibilities to explain things, so you're not just always sort of jumping to, you know, some assumption or, you know, pre-held conclusions that might be sometimes limiting new understanding. And so when I started first checking him out, I so the wisdom of crowds phenomenon was discovered in, I think, the 1800s, where people were guessing the weight of cattle at this county fair. And somebody happened to notice when they averaged the crowd's guesses, it was very close, remarkably close to the actual weight of the animal, like within a pound or so, versus the experts who were able to always get within several pounds, but rarely beat the actual whole crowd. And the crowd's guesses needed to be sort of like a bell-shaped curve. You know, there needed to be really high, you know, high values and really low values. And they just all sort of averaged out to be very close to accurate.
Very close to accurate indeed. Well, non-subscribers, our time is up here. So if you want to find out whether Jesse gets around to convincing me that the entities Paul Selig channels are giving us anything useful, or whether you suspect this is going to devolve into him reading an Amazon.com review of a book, well, he does. I don't know if that's interesting or not. I'm going to get fired. All right, non-subscribers, click the subscribe tab and get yourself not just the rest of this episode, commercial-free and in its entirety, but all of the Experience episodes, all of Dreamland, and all everything Whitley has on tap for subscribers for a nominal fee. Do it today. And either way, check out Jesse Herbert's website, www.tributetutoring.com. That's all one word, tributetutoring.com. All right, I'll see you next week. Take care.